Welcome back to the Creator Spotlight Podcast. Our guest today is Justin Gordon. He started blogging way back in 2012 as a fitness coach and has produced hundreds, maybe thousands of articles and podcasts over the years. But back in 2018, while working to get an MBA, he started blogging about entrepreneurship. Then he started a podcast interviewing entrepreneurs a few months later. And today, his main focus as a creator, at least, is his 21,000 plus subscriber newsletter, Just Go Grind. And on that newsletter, he still interviews some entrepreneurs, but mostly writes thousands of words long profiles about people like Sam Altman, Daniel Ek, and Coco Chanel. Is there anything else you'd want to add?
That's great. There's so many things, but that's a great intro.
You're a guy who does a lot of things. Okay, so I'm not sure exactly how many people you've interviewed. I think it's somewhere around 500, probably more, honestly. But the reason I bring that up is, like, when I interview people for this, I don't think I'm necessarily learning, like, a new thing specifically every time. Maybe, like, you know, if I've interviewed probably 100 people since the beginning of last year. And maybe those 100 people, I'm making up these numbers, but, like, maybe I've learned 10 things, right? But I've learned 10 different angles on each thing. So my question to you is, like, do you feel like you've learned something new every time you research or interview somebody? Or, like, what is the new thing you gain from each new interview? Because I just don't think it can be 500 new things. Like, full
new. It's definitely not 500 new things. I think what you end up happening with it is you have some things that stand out, and then some things that are kind of almost like reaffirmed across different industries or reaffirmed across different categories. And you're like, oh, I heard that from this person 2 years ago, and now they're talking about a similar thing. Or they took this approach to that. Oh, they're taking the completely opposite approach. So does it really not matter then what approach you take in this particular, like, category, whatever? So anywhere from when I started the podcast in 2018, I mean, there's founders from that all across the spectrum of a lot of early stage, but across CPG, across tech, across media, et cetera. And then, as I said, kind of these, like, world-class founders for the newsletter too. Like, now it's a similar thing that some of these people are, like Coco Chanel, you mentioned, like, obviously she's been dead a long time, but the brand is still going. There's, like, a whole different spectrum of when she was building a company and, like, kind of that structure of how she set it up. And she basically got startup capital back then as well, which you could say, you know, it wasn't like a VC back thing, but then she had some guy that gave her basically like a room or like a little space to sell hats out of. And that kind of started the whole empire that is Chanel. So then today you have people who have got startup capital as a kid in their dorm room. It's like dorm room fund, for instance. It's like, it's some of the things transfer on terms of that. And then the different ways people have approached acquiring customers, different ways people have approached building the team. Some of those things kind of carry over time, and you learn some of those lessons. But it's definitely not 500 lessons. But some of the things that stand out to me are always the things that just pop up repeatedly. And so whether it be the importance of building a team and how people have gone about that, whether it be how you approach the sequencing even of focusing on acquiring customers versus like the distribution side versus the product side, and how some people take product first, some people take a more of a distribution approach first. And any media creator or like content creator, they're taking a lot of times a distribution approach first and using that to sell products or services, versus some people who are product people have gone the opposite, create a great product, and then they'll figure it out, you know, after that in terms of distribution. So it's all over the board on different things, but it's been fun to see the different journeys.
Well, I feel like what you're describing is like you're searching for patterns, which is like, it's not the new things. It's like, I don't know, when you were talking about that too, like, oh, if this person who works in this industry is doing this one thing, and then this person in an entirely other industry is doing it in another thing. I think it's like that angle thing. And I'm thinking about it, it's like you're at a gallery, an art gallery, or like a museum. You're looking at some sculpture, and it's like there's the one sculpture, but you're walking around it and like seeing like different ways it works in different contexts and different lighting. And that's like when you learn like that Coco Chanel took, you know, some form of capital, and then X entrepreneur also took some form of capital. It's like same coin, different sides, maybe not just a two-sided, many-sided coin, it's a many-sided dice, or Dungeons and Dragons style.
Right.
So the podcast, though, you started it in 2018, summer 2018. Yeah. But what's really interesting to me is that in August 2020, you switched from doing it weekly to daily, specifically not like every, you know, work day, but 7 days a week. And I'm pretty sure you did this for over 100 days. So you started first day of August, you did all of August, all of September, all of October, And then November, you fall off a little bit. But then you, after that, you're still doing it like 3 days a week, if not more, for a little while.
Yeah.
And all that just to say, like, that sounds horrible to me as like somebody who does a podcast. Like, it sounds like a bad idea for me. Like, I feel like I'd get burnt out. I'd worry that nobody is listening to them. It's horrifying to me. So I really want to know why you did that and what it was like.
I think it was from hearing a podcast. I want to say it's a marketing podcast, like by Single Grain, this marketing agency that had done it daily. And I'd heard how they grew through a daily podcast. And I had seen daily podcasts that had done really well, even like Entrepreneur on Fire back in the day, I think was daily as well, with John Lee Dumas. I remember hearing that like years and years ago. And so when I was doing my podcast, I was trying to think of any type of way to grow, because it is so hard to grow audience. And then I also knew that, like, okay, if I do more episodes, I will just meet more founders. I don't know where this is going to lead to, but I will build a network even faster versus one time a week. It's like 7 times a week. And also then the thing I love about a daily anything, which is I fought the urge to do a daily newsletter, but trust me, it's still in my mind always, is that the habit of doing anything daily. And I used to tell my clients this when I was a personal trainer way back in the day, was like, there's not a question of if you'll do it or not. The question is, what am I doing for this thing? So it really shifts everything doing
it daily. It's reps.
So for the, it's reps. And for the podcast, it was the same way. When I knew I was doing it daily, it was like, my eyes were always open to, okay, who could be a potential guest? And I had a high bar. A lot of these people had raised millions of dollars in venture capital, or they were investors who were great. And so I was on Twitter all the time. I was like looking on LinkedIn, always like asking for referrals. It made it way simpler to be like, or reach out, being if you have an ambitious thing you're doing, it's easier for people to help you. Mm-hmm. So I would reach out to people and be like, hey, I'm doing this daily podcast. I need guests all the time, but they have to be great. Do you know 1 or 2 people? And I like constantly ask. Yeah. And people would be like, oh, I'll definitely help you. You're doing what? That's insane. How are you doing that? But then if it is insane, people give you more help because they're like, oh, it's more ambitious that you're doing this thing.
Yeah.
So it's why.
If you're like biking across the country, it's like way easier to get strangers to let you like sleep in their yard or their house other than being like, oh, I'm like biking across town. Can I stay at your house tonight? It's like, no.
Yeah. No one gets sponsors for a bike ride to their neighbor's house, right?
Yeah.
Like you get sponsors for a bike ride across the country. It's more ambitious. And so I always like, as part of like the, I think the Tim Ferriss thing around Magic of Thinking Big, he always recommended that book and talked about it. And you say like, it's easier to pursue more ambitious goals oftentimes because there's less competition and people are willing to help you. So I had that in mind too when I did that. I was like, what's a more ambitious version of what I was doing? And the podcast is called Just Go Grind. So like clearly, like
it's on brand.
I live that. Yeah, it's on brand to be like, I'm doing this daily. And I did meet so many great founders through that I have still like kept in touch with and know, and I always knew like the relationship side of podcasting and media is what I loved, how you could leverage like media to meet people. And then now doing a lot more with that now we can get into, but like always kind of had that in mind. And that's the only reason why I stopped daily, is because I got into VC from that. So that's why.
Oh, okay. So that, I love that. Like, I always think like with any type of creator, there's some kind of monetization in the goal, but like monetization can be getting a job or like network, like something that brings you some kind of monetary benefit down the line. So a few questions here. One, it got you this job, but did it grow the podcast?
It did. I mean, downloads grew, and then inherently the audience kind of, the momentum kind of grew from that. It was still, it's never been like huge. It's always been like relatively small. It's kind of niche in some ways. It definitely grew the podcast. I think the thing that also, if you're thinking about like as a creator hat is on, you're thinking of surviving. If you have something that's smaller, it's fine. But when I was doing it daily, the amount of ad slots I had then is more as well. So it was easier to pitch. And like, I got maybe a couple of sponsors for it where it was like, okay, maybe it's like $2,000 or something. And it's like for one episode, obviously it's like way too much given the downloads, but it's like, okay, I have 7 a week though. And there's always new things I'm promoting on social
or
the podcast. So there's lots of surface area. Exactly. And then you can think about the amount of content I can create with having a daily podcast. There's so much to repurpose and stuff. So
what about like each podcast? I'd say I scrolled through this period on Spotify. Yeah. I think the average length is probably 50 minutes. So I'm interested in a bit of the process. We don't have to go too granular, but like how long before you start, how long before August 1st had you started like pre-recording and getting people booked, and like were you doing like batch recording in a day? How did you pull this off executionally?
Yeah, I was a little bit ahead, but not much. I might have been like a week ahead of interviews that were like ready to roll, but not much more than that. So the actual process then, so I had one assistant help me on the editing side of things. I did a lot of it myself in the early days, but I did have someone help me after a little bit. But I had maybe like seven episodes kind of ready to roll. So I had a little bit of like leeway. And then I would just batch as many as I could in a week. And so, I mean, the most I did was maybe like four-ish or five, maybe. I think it was four in a day. And that's a lot of like mental space.
Yeah. Wait, how long, like how many hours would you spend per episode in terms of like research, recording, prep, et cetera?
It varied. So normally for that, it was like hours and hours of research. Still, like I do deep dive research for these deep dives. Yeah. I think you have to be prepared because what happens is so many times I get guests that would come on and they would, I love it when they say like, oh, I didn't like you, what you did your homework or you did your research or like, you really, that makes it stand out. And there's a reason for that. And I can give them that too. But it's a whole process for like, if you do a good job with that and they have had an amazing experience, and part of that is the research you did beforehand. Remember, I was doing it daily. I needed recommendations from every guest. So what I would do at the end of the episode is I would always ask for a recommendation to another potential guest. And if I did my homework and did it better in that episode, they're more likely to give me another referral to other good guests. And these are people who like, at the time I didn't have a network that was too huge. So like being able to refer to other like vetted kind of like venture back founders who had raised a lot of money or like who are hard to reach if I just cold outreach to them, I needed those recommendations. So that was helpful. So there was like hours of research for each one. So to do three or four in a day, that means I was doing research on each one before then to prep. So like it was, at the most, it was probably like 10 or 15 episodes in like a week I would do.
Jeez.
Yeah.
That's insane.
But constantly ongoing, just you have to be ready to roll. Yeah. And that was like you said, 100 days. So it was like 3 months, 4 months of that.
I again, like to me, I would not do that personally. That's just not something I would do.
I don't recommend it.
Would you do it again? Or like, would you recommend people do that? Or like, would you recommend people do a similar thing in a different way?
I actually think it's great for jumpstarting any project as a purely, and there's different like trains of thought.
Well, famously, like Ship 30 for 30 is a big, you know, thing people do.
Exactly. I think the benefit of it is it gets you reps on becoming better at the art of doing podcasts and doing outreach and getting momentum and having something to promote daily that you can just like, you know, you have a new episode to promote. So you always have to be kind of promoting and self-promoting and shipping, which some people struggle with that. I've gotten over that after like years of blogging, but like, that was helpful too. So I think from that perspective, it's helpful. The problem is like you have to be willing to kind of suck it up a little bit because it's hard, obviously, but also figure out the monetization, make it make sense. Because it's way easier to do that when you have money coming in for each episode, right? So like there's trade-offs on that. But for me, I mean, it was so worth it. Thinking bigger picture, it was incredibly worth it.
Tough at the time, but life-changing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So one more thing about podcasting, 6 months into podcasting. So before your marathon, you wrote this Medium article, 6 lessons learned from 6 months of podcasting. And I'll read what those 6 things are. So just start, don't be afraid to ask, as in ask guests to come on. Don't expect perfection, have backups, meaning audio specifically, get referrals to guests and do your homework. So 6 lessons from 6 months of podcast. It's been about 6 years since then. Is there anything you'd add or change?
I don't know if the lessons, like the main takeaway from podcasting in general has been relationship building. It is like the best tool for doing that. It gives you an excuse to reach out to anyone. A lot of people are willing to come on a podcast. I think a lot of people will make time if you've done your homework and done all those things that I've mentioned in there, is like they will jump on and do a podcast. And if you use it the right way, like it's almost like second to none in terms of relationship building. Because even like, obviously, like in person is the like top thing for building relationships. But most of these people, if you want to expand outside your city and kind of broaden your network and have these second connections, second level connections and stuff, I think it's the best thing. But I would just say that if you approach it more strategically, it's helpful. So I'll give you some context. So I knew from the beginning this is going to be great for building relationships. But if you just do a podcast interview and that's it, you've kind of wasted that podcast interview in my head. Because what you could do or should do, one, like, are you following them on social already? Are you kind of engaging and having those like nudges? But also, like, I would ping all the guests. I'll give you an example. I just did this week. I pinged almost all the podcast guests that were relevant for this new thing I'm building called Village Lane. So I pinged them just like giving an update of like, hey, by the way, here's what I'm up to now. And I did that for when I joined a venture firm, when we launched an angel group, when I left the venture firm. Those things that people probably wouldn't think to do, and it takes a lot of time because it's like 350 something messages I just sent.
Yeah, individually.
Like, exactly. Like that's something like, oh, why would I spend the hours on that? because it's worth it if you're playing the long game. And even though a few people will, you know, not care at all or not respond, I always get people to respond and still keep that up after years. Like, I'm having a call tomorrow with someone who I haven't talked with in 4 years, but we've kept in touch from the podcast, which is insane to me. But I think that's the best part of the podcasting thing, is like the relationship building side of it is just second to none.
Yeah. Okay. I want to move on from podcasting though. So the newsletter, get into the details of it. It's like, it's called Just Go Grind. It's this thing that's evolved from like your early days of blogging about career, entrepreneurship, and now it's largely these founder profiles. But before we get into what it is, what are the stats? Over 21,000 subscribers. So what's the subscribers open rate and click rate?
Yeah, subscribers are around 21,000. Open rate's around, I have to think about this, look it up. It's like probably 45. Click rate varies, honestly. Click rate's probably like 2%. So probably pretty low, on relatively low, because like depends on like what you gauge it by. Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of the baseline, at least of it.
45. So
yeah.
What about, I mean, I feel like your newsletter isn't a big click newsletter.
Yeah, because they're reading a deep dive profile, which has been a whole different vibe.
What exactly. Is it, like 2% or something?
Yeah, like 2%.
That's pretty good for what it is. The first issue of your newsletter, I found like as it exists today, as like a dedicated thing, seems to be from December 2022, which was like a review of your 2022 and, you know, your plans for 2023. And it, as you know, in the top, you sent it to 519 subscribers. So that was, 19 months ago or something like that. So why did you start this? Again, it's like this 12-year thing of you making content in various ways. Why did this thing happen where you started doing this like dedicated newsletter?
I mean, it's funny thinking about like things that people prioritize in terms of careers. I always kind of have prioritized things around impact, things I'm inherently curious about, things that can eventually get big, because I'm willing to wait and I want. So like that's kind of always. So at the time, give more context, at the time working full-time at Vitalize Venture Capital, was doing the podcast, still had shut down a founder community. I was like an online founder community I was running. Too many things going on, right? So I paused the podcast like not long after that. And I just wanted to get back to writing again. I'd done it for like a decade, so I wanted to get back to like writing on the internet. And I just had some ideas that I wanted to like share. I didn't really know at all where it was going to go. I didn't really plan on it being a thing necessarily, but I knew that I'd seen other people writing more. I want to get back into like a newsletter. I kind of have played with newsletters in the past in different formats. Justin's Journal was one of those. I think there's like a startup hiring one. There's like other stuff I played with. And that's where those 500 subscribers came from, like past newsletters I just imported. And I just want to start getting these ideas together. And so that was like the genesis for a minute. Obviously it evolved, which I can get into, but it evolved over this like first couple of months. But I just had certain things I wanted to get out. And I think any project I've done, it's always kind of stemmed from that, of like something I just want to do and we'll see how it turns into something bigger.
Yeah. You got a lot of motion.
I think it's helpful.
Yeah. So 519 subscribers then to over 21,000 now is quite good growth. And like 21,000 is like a super strong list. Where did they come from? How did you grow it?
Yeah, it's a mix. So I started with organic originally because I had a Twitter audience, which is helpful. So I built that up over time. So like, let's see, by 2023, which was really when I switched to the current format, probably had 20,000 maybe Twitter followers, something like that. Definitely leveraged that. So I probably got to like the first 3,000-ish maybe around that subscribers organically. Started doing paid ads a little bit after that, and I think of the timing, took a newsletter course with like Jack Rains and Nathan Baugh. That was helpful. Learned a little bit more about paid acquisition, used that as well to grow it a little bit more, which was helpful to get that to kind of a critical mass, because for me it was, I liked doing the newsletter. It was taking up a lot of time because the deep dives take forever, which I get into to write. And then I was like, you know, working at Vitalize. So I wanted to grow to a point where I could, can I get this to a point faster where I can potentially figure out what this thing is and maybe quit my job, which is what ended up happening by May.
Okay. By last May.
Yeah. Last May, 2023.
Okay. How many subscribers did you have at that point?
I think it was like 7,000 or 8,000 maybe.
Okay.
By then. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we keep talking about like what the newsletter has become now. So when I look through it, there's like, I think there's about 72 issues since that first 2022, 2023 planning one. 56 of these are your like in-depth profiles, which, you know, the first one, which was February 2023, was Sam Altman from obviously OpenAI. It's like 3,700 words long, and you sent it to 677 people. And this seems to be the genesis of this format. And then the rest are like, you've done maybe a dozen interviews, like obviously kind of an evolution of the podcast. There's a few like five lessons from, you know, Stuart Butterfield or other entrepreneur, but it's by and large these in-depth profiles. So tell me why you started doing these profiles and what they mean to you.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So I was listening to My First Million podcast.
Yeah.
And they were talking about their Billy of the Week. And it's a fun segment they had. And they were talking about Sam Altman. And I think they had
Billy mentioned... of the Week. It's like Fool of the Week. Whoever made it's like Donkey of the Week.
No, on a, like they're right, billionaire.
Oh, billion. Of the week. Yeah.
Like Billy that way. Yeah. So like they were like talking about Sam Altman. They were talking about his. I think they had mentioned his investment in like Helion or something. The name of it. It's like a couple hundred million himself invested. And I was just like, wait. I know Sam Altman. Like I've heard of him at the time. Like I knew like Y Combinator related, whatever. I didn't know the depth of his investing and other stuff he had done. And I was just, again, I do things that I'm inherently curious about and we'll see what they become. So I was just like, okay, I've done these kind of deep dives on founder workouts a decade ago. And now we came back into writing. I was just like, all right, let me start to research Sam and maybe I'll do like a piece on him and see what this thing becomes. And so it took me a couple of weeks. I didn't have any format down. I don't know how much I spent a lot of time researching because also I didn't have any like idea of this process and what it would be. Yeah, no system in place or anything. And so that was over the course of like 2 weeks, I put together this thing. And again, still working full time. So it was a lot, but I love the process of it. Like figuring it out, like basically it's going through old articles or profiles of him, listening to podcasts, watching videos, and then curating that into like one cohesive piece and one cohesive like narrative of his story. And I found it just utterly fascinating because I wasn't limited by who I had access to, like I was with the podcast, and I wasn't limited by like a time constraint the same way of like, I have an hour to talk to them. How much can I get out of them in an hour? And also then I can corroborate like their story across different versions if they've ever told it differently to be like, like what's consistent or not, or like they mentioned this, but actually they mentioned closer to the time it actually happening. This is how it was. I trust that more. So there's like other things like that I just found fascinating. And that was the genesis for doing deep dives. And it morphed from there in a lot of different ways. But
Do you have a preference between doing those or doing interviews?
They're so different. So the current, like right now with working on a new venture, again, called Village Lane, more of a community focused thing. Like the deep dives take 20, 30 hours.
Yeah.
Podcasts are just way shorter, which in some ways is helpful from doing it. But I think I enjoy the research phase of the newsletter piece probably more because I just get to consume a ton of content.
Like there's so many directions to go in.
Yeah. Sometimes the actual putting those pieces together is less fun, let's just say.
Buddy, especially, I know it.
Yeah. So there's that piece of it. But you just kind of do it because, you know, I'm fueled by clicking publish. Mm-hmm. So having done all the research, then I'm just like, I want to publish this thing. I want to get it out there. I think it's going to be useful. So slog through the rest of it to make an actual cohesive narrative.
Mm-hmm. So a couple of questions about these profiles. One, like I read through a couple of them and like just looking at the mass of them, I'm like, so many of these people are very well covered. So like, obviously my first question was like, well, what's additive about what you're doing? How are you telling this story in a new way? Or like, what's the layer you've added by collecting these things? Which the way you're kind of saying it, I'll say something and then let you answer. The way you're kind of saying it is that like you are corroborating these different things, different ways they've said it. And then like what I kind of landed on as like what I thought the greatest value was like, you've got this audience of now 21,000 people and you've got great open rate, right? You said like 45%. So it seems like to me, maybe one of the main values is like, regardless even of the way you're telling the story, it's the curation of it and this like delivering of it to the audience in a way where maybe they weren't going to look up Sam Altman this week, but you've delivered it to them. Anyways, I don't want to put too many words in your mouth. So yeah, what do you think is like the thing that you're bringing that's additive of what you're doing on these stories that have been told?
Yeah, the problem inherently with any of these people I cover is because they've done so many different, some of them have done like a ton of podcasts and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so like done a bunch of interviews, some haven't as many. So it's a little bit different, but there's always bits and pieces that are missing or
yeah,
they add, even if I listen to one podcast, so typically you know this too, it varies from like 10 sources to like 30, 40 sources, depending yeah. on like, it could be one source if it's a book for someone, but it could be a lot of sources. So there's always bits and pieces they add to each one where, okay, there's this one thing here that was good. There's this one thing here that was good. There's this other thing here that was good, but they didn't have it all in one spot. And to me, I like things that are complete. And like, I can ask anyone who like talks to me, that's like, I'm organized, very organized on things. I like mm-hmm. things in their place. I like to like have it in one spot. So like to these people I write about, I want this story and this narrative and their insights in like one spot, both for me personally and then other people find it useful.
You've got this completionist tendency.
Yeah, like just in terms of that, like if I'm gonna do it, I'll do it deep dive. Like that's why it's like impossible to do a daily newsletter for me, because I don't know how I can complete something daily. And I would do it, but it had to be the right format that would seem enough to me organized in a way that was also beneficial. And it's like you're kind of attracting inherently a different audience because it is so, the depth is there. And I'm not going for mass appeal. So yeah. like, I don't care if it's ever going to be mass appeal, because to me, it's like people who would enjoy these stories the most, like a friend of mine who is like a Series B founder and he yeah. like likes the newsletter a lot. And like, he doesn't really, he's a hard critic. So him saying it, he's like legit when he says it, like he enjoys it. That like is a win for me because he has a high bar. Other people who said the same thing when I've talked to them, and like, I don't get a ton of feedback always on it. But when people will tell me, it's like, oh yeah, the newsletter, like mm-hmm. keep that going, by the way.
It's well, again, it sounds like the podcast, it's like this network value is such a huge part of why you do what you do.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. That's like the main thing. And this is just way better in terms of this person news, but podcast. Yes, they can both scale, but just way easier to scale a newsletter.
Yeah.
Now it's different, like audience, of course, in terms of like, you're not having them for an hour listen to a podcast. You have them for less time, but mm-hmm. if they're going to read the newsletter, it's going to take them 20 minutes if they want
to. Well, wait, actually. So I'm curious though, like about the audience and your relationship to them, like 21,000, it's sure that's still not mass appeal, but that's like quite a large audience for a newsletter. Who do you know, like who they are from on like a mass scale or like individually yeah. people you didn't know earlier?
Yeah. And I've used like forums to get some feedback. So I know it's more than half that are founders. Mm-hmm. Others are a mixture, operators. There's definitely some investors there as well. It's interesting because especially early on, followed it a little bit more in terms of looking at every single subscriber that comes in, and you're like looking yeah. through who are they, whatever.
Google their name if you can.
Super early days. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But like it's an interesting list because it's like, I know people on that list who are founders of multi-billion-dollar companies and some like tier one VCs, but also people who are just getting started or operators. So it's like a full spectrum of it because of the depth of it and because mm-hmm. of who I cover. It attracts this like unique kind of group of people. But inherently, if anyone's going to subscribe to a newsletter and they stay subscribed and it's like sometimes 7,000 words, they care about the subject or the topic, and they're probably filtering for some level of ambition and stuff. So like all those things to me, like I never really cared about the size that much. Is more like,
yeah,
I'm gonna keep writing how I want to write. Yeah, the who, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so that's like the big benefit of doing it at least that way for me.
Yeah. So I'm struck by something. Like I've talked to a few people who are creators, but they're also athletes. And so I know you played football in college and you're a big runner. I get the sense of like the way you do things is like you're just at full tilt. You're always kind of running, like leaning forwards. You're like falling forwards, but just running fast. If I have a question here, it's like, is there a relationship between like, do you think between like you being an athlete and the way you do these things? Like, is there a mindset that is the same for both or something?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. Like, if you look at being an athlete also and just researching these people I research every week, to get to where they want to get to, whether you want to be an elite athlete or you want to create a big company or even just the best company, whatever, it takes massive action. Like, massive action is like the only way you get there. So I've always, as a baseline, been like, I will for sure be taking plenty of action in anything I do, because I will get more feedback, I'll move faster, mm-hmm. whatever. And I like journal every day. I have a daily journal. I journal every single, so I always like reflect and think back. So like, even though I'm sprinting, I do take the rest, because I'm a former personal trainer and exercise sports science major and all that. So like, I understand the importance of rest, but the thing that separates most people is just action. Like even anyone you like always research, all these people, I've had done all these interviews, it's always just action. And there's just like normal people who then took a ton of action. And then that over time makes them seem very much so not normal, I would say. And I always say, like, I love these like crazy people. And most of my friends are founders who are crazy as well. And so like, for me, it's like table stakes. So, like if I'm like, people see some of the running stuff or they're like waking up super early or the daily podcast and all that. But to me, like I'm looking at like the crazy David Goggins of the world or like the crazy like founders who like took things way too far.
Well, there's, there's this quote I like about Kobe Bryant that he like, he's the lead scorer of the NBA, but also the leader in shots missed, right? He just took more shots. Yeah,
for sure. I mean, and also did he just play long enough to have such so many accomplishments in his career, right? But like the action part of it to me was always just like, that's table stakes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that is something I can control super easily. I could use stoicism every day. Like that's table stakes is the action piece of it. And like, at least if that's the case, I know I would be making progress towards things and I always like kind of step back and reflect, but I will always be making progress and not be like, I don't want to make mistakes from being a sloth and not moving fast. That to me is like unacceptable.
Yeah. We, you know, we've been talking about all these things you do. How do you actually make money? Like if the newsletter is a loss leader and it's like helping you funnel to all these things, you know, I don't necessarily need you to tell me like exactly how much money you make, et cetera, but like, how do you make a living within all these different things?
Yeah. So early on, so the before I quit Vitalize, the main thing I wanted was like validation on sponsorships. So when I got my first sponsor, I was like, okay, it's like just like a mental weight of I can get sponsors for this newsletter was lifted off. And then it was like, in my head, it's always like, if you do it once, you do it twice, right? So like I got a sponsor. It was clear that I could get another sponsor at some point in time. And so then it was like, okay, I used that to get sponsors. So the majority of the thing has been sponsors so far. I had a paid subscription I launched in like end of May, maybe June last year. That was like a mixture kind of like online community and like bonus content. So I did that as well. So those are like been the kind of two pillars of making money for this whole thing over time. Mm-hmm. Now it's evolving. So now we'll see.
Also real quick before I move on from sponsors. So it's like, this goes back to like, you don't need a huge audience because it's who is in the audience. So you're able to charge to get these way specific higher sponsors and charge higher rates because you have this like very value concentrated audience.
Yeah. And also the market's definitely changed last year in terms of ad rates and sponsors and all that. So it's still like a premium always. So maybe at the peak I've gotten over $100 CPM. Now it's less for sure. Like it's been more like 50 or 75, but at the peak it's that.
Still very good. Like,
yeah. And like there's variance, right? You know, you charge more, it's harder to get sponsors, all that sort of thing. So I think for the first like long time, it was sponsors and then it's like paid subscription. So that fueled enough to like survive off of, et cetera. And then as I've changed in this community thing, it's evolved to like, I've kind of taken a step back, both from like outreach for sponsors and like this paid newsletter, all of that. I'm rethinking everything. So I've killed off communities that I've started that were had paying members, because it just didn't feel like the right thing. So I'm not afraid to do that.
You got to know when to quit.
Yeah. Even if it's making money and people are like, why are you starting? Like, maybe just find a different way to do it. I'm like, no, I don't want to do it. My energy is not there. So I'm like, not going to do it. So now the focus is on like Village Lane as a membership community is part of it. Sponsors, I took a step back for a little bit, but now it's like more evolving around sponsors will be a mix of like event sponsors, some media assets with the newsletter, the Luma calendar I have, like they can promote in there. It's like a mixture of things. I haven't quite figured it out yet, but I'm definitely prioritizing members. So to your point of the audience, there's 21,000 subscribers. Like I'd rather have a thing that's $1,000, $2,000 bucks a year or whatever, or $100 a month, whatever, that type of price point for a membership thing. Mm-hmm. To me, long-term for my audience, like that's what I just want to run. So I'm transitioning towards that.
You have enough people that will pay more than you have like total people who will pay a $5 a month thing.
That's the thesis.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean,
talk to me in a year.
Yeah, exactly. Depends what you
right,
can
we'll
offer.
See.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that those incentives align a lot for what I want to build. So that's where I'm shifting now to that, which is a little adjustment period to just figure out like what this looks like now. So now it's like giving up some maybe short-term revenue for longer term, what you want to build, which I'm happy to do as long as I have enough runway.
Speaking of that, so I'm curious more about Village Lane. So does this spring out of like the Just Go Grind meetups you're doing where you're like, this is interesting, it's working, I'm like facilitating these things, I think I can do it, with more value on a higher scale.
Yeah, and like some of that, it's like 40 or 50 discovery calls with founders too, and like a vetted thing that's like a vetted community of some sort is what people wanted, especially like if you imagine some founder who's like raised money or a founder who's like done 100K revenue, which is the requirements, like they want to be around others who have done the same, not someone who's just getting started. So otherwise it's just kind of like they're not getting value from it, but they are just giving value. Yeah, so it's like a hard, yes, it has to be in some way. So like the LA kind of startup ecosystem events I'm doing for Just Go Grind, those are free, they're open. So I think you can allow some serendipity. Village Land is more vetted. Now the vetting can change in terms of like those requirements. Like right now it's like 100K in revenue or 250K raise minimum. Those may change. Like I don't know if I'll keep them forever that exact way, but it'll always be vetted in some way. Like I have a call with everyone who applies. So like it's so early. I like only a couple weeks ago launched it. So I'm still like having member calls and all of that and figuring out what this looks like. But that's very much so intentionally a higher price point membership thing, which I haven't really done much of before. So we'll see how it ends up playing out. And you have to kind of overcome this like cold start problem of getting members, which is going to be fun. But I have applicants and like I can work that list. So I wanted a distinctly separate thing that was membership and that was in-person focused, and that I could use the media to drive people to that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, just a couple more questions. One, what is the most disastrous interview you've ever done as an interviewer? And you don't have to like name names, that, you know, if you want to, you can. But I'm more interested in like, as somebody who interviews people, I'd love to learn like what went wrong, why it was bad. Maybe there's not. Maybe you've, you know, knocked it out of the park every time.
Oh, no, there's definitely one.
Okay, yeah. Let me know.
There's one who was like this is like typically not always a telltale sign, but like there's one who reached out to me specifically to be on the show. This was like early on.
I usually say no to those. I'm always skeptical.
Exactly. Very much so. And I didn't know that because it was early. It was maybe the first like 30 or 40, one of the first ones. And it was when I was doing not necessarily just founders. It was kind of across the board. So this one, they droned on about everything. Every answer, I feel like I couldn't get them to be concise in any way, shape, or form. And I would take full responsibility for some of that when it's like you get to warn your guests like how to do that, especially if they haven't been on a show before. They don't know. So some blame on me for that. But they droned on it for every answer. And it was clear they were kind of like sell more than like
than chat.
Be natural. Then have a conversation. It wasn't a conversation at all, which wasn't enjoyable for me. It lasted way too long. It felt like, how do I get out of this? Like it was a lot of like, I felt trapped behind the mic. It was terrible. And I was like, never again. Like I will never again. Like I will be more prepared. I will make sure to vet the guests more.
Taught you the lesson.
I will only talk to people who like I'm genuinely think I'll be excited to chat with. And this was already hesitant in the beginning, and I went with it anyways, and like all of those things I would never do again.
Yeah. So that was, you said that was the first 30. What about the best interview on the opposite side? And why was it? Why did it go so well?
I almost always think of Rob Mather from Against Malaria Foundation. Anything where people like think differently about things, I love, because that just like changes your whole mindset, shift, whatever. But he started Against Malaria Foundation. It's basically like one of the most impactful charities in the world. So like if you look up like charity rankings and stuff, like Against Malaria Foundation always ranks like highest, or like one of the highest, like every year. And started from like, you know, wanting to make an impact. And one of the things he mentioned in that interview, which is why I enjoyed it so much, was like this idea, I don't know if it's like 7 minute thing here, the idea basically of using like only a few minutes of time, how could you make maximum impact? For him, it was like a 1 minute call with like 5 to 10 of the most impactful, like important people that would help his cause. And it just makes you think a little bit different when people put limits on something, or they put like these our own kind of blockers on things. It's like you could really probably do 10 times, 100 times more than you think if you kind of thought of it or took a different approach to it. Which is why sometimes it's hard when you're just kind of cranking through stuff. You're like, well, but if you took a step back and maybe it'd actually be better. So that interview was just enjoyable, building something impactful, learn some things from it. It was a joy to talk to. And I've had many interviews that I truly have enjoyed. Like you sit back after, you're like, what just happened? That was amazing. Like you're like kind of like had to take a walk or something.
Yeah.
I've had many of those. But Rob Mather from Against Malaria Foundation is always one of the ones that stands out.
I'll check that one out. Okay. How about any advice for for other podcasters, anybody out there who like is, you know, whether they're thinking of starting one or they're deep in one, what advice would you give about podcasting?
I mean, at first it's always just about like figuring out what you want from it.
Okay.
And you may not know at the beginning, but having at least an idea of what you want from it is something. I knew I wanted to build relationships as a starting point. So
Sorry to interrupt. That's really interesting to me. Cause like it's clear that that's what came out of it for you, but like,
yeah,
I'm surprised that that was like what went into like, that was your thing at the start. It's like, this is a networking tool for me.
Yeah. Because I was doing it as blog posts originally, but I didn't get to talk to people and form a relationship with them. When I was doing it as blog posts,
I was doing guest posts, written interviews. Survey interviews or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I was like, well, I can't talk to them. I can't ask follow-ups. I can't like build any rapport with them. So then I was like, wait a minute, it has to be a podcast.
You can't interrupt them like I just did you to ask a follow-up question. Right.
You can't do that. But some interruption is good, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Jason Calacanis asks us maybe sometimes too much, as an example. Love his style, but it always stands out to me when some people do too much of it. But you can't do any of that with a written interview, which is the limitations.
Yeah. How about for newsletters? But, what's a piece of advice for people to, especially, and I really ask this of you because like part of why I wanted to interview you is like people don't write 7,000. You just don't write 7,000 word newsletters. It's not done. So that's one of the main reasons I actually wanted to talk to you. I was like, this guy's doing something different. So yeah, what advice would you give to people trying to write a newsletter? Besides, like, I think it's the same reason. Like, figure out why you're doing it. But beyond that, like, format specific is it?
Yeah. I mean, I have strong opinions on that. Always, like, I think the thing of like, Acquired as a podcast, for instance. I know I've come on newsletters, but Acquired as a podcast, for instance, like breaking every rule of podcasting because that's what they wanted to do and they're just kind of scratching their own itch and whatever. And you find your people through that. I think more people should be doing that without worrying about constraints.
Yes.
Just based on what do you want to create, period. If it would have been like asking me, I would have followed the advice, done like a super short newsletter, maybe had it daily because it was like, you had the Morning Brew, you had the Hustle, you had like the Milk Road, always ones, right? That would have been probably the advice if I'll like. But to me, it was always like, what am I going to find interesting enough to be able to do consistently? And that has always been a thing I wanted to like try to pursue. It's like the things I would just enjoy doing anyways. And so like I was already researching people in some capacity, being like, I'm curious about Sam. Like I would just do that. So like then it's like, okay, I can make a business out of this or make a thing out of it. So for anyone like starting a newsletter, it's like, what is the thing you just are curious about anyways? And then you start and it morphs from there. But like the newsletter, you know, I started in late 2022, I didn't release the deep dive until 2023, February. So because I just got started on something and kind of scratched my own itch on the whole, like wanting to write something, and it morphed because I knew it was going to change probably over time. That's how it became a thing. But not because like I started knowing I want to write deep dives. So it just morphed over time. So I think anyone get started and kind of pursue your curiosity is always just because like the thing, I always go back to Tim Ferriss stuff, which is, consumable of his content, but like, the thing is like, if you can do something and you learn and win, even if it's a quote unquote loss, like that's the goal for my stuff. So like you do a podcast, what's the worst thing that happens? You had some good conversations with people. Cool. So like, that is like, I will do that again and again, because looking back on it, I wouldn't find it to be a waste.
Yeah.
Same with the writing of newsletter. I wouldn't find it to be a waste to publish a newsletter.
Worst thing you got better ideas at writing.
Yeah, exactly. You get better at writing. I wanted to publish these things, these ideas I wanted to be out there anyways. And so like, even when I've created content around like my MBA experience, I still get people to comment on a video I made about my MBA experience from like years ago, because I just want to get that out there. I knew some people would find it interesting. And we're 4 years later from that, and I still get responses to that.
Well, which is really interesting, actually, with your YouTube channel. I was checking it out. You've got like 122 videos, I think, exactly. And most of them, about half of them, have like under 100 views. A few of them have thousands of views. But again, it's like the same thing. It's like, do the thing. Worst case scenario, you get better at doing the thing, or you meet people.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, yeah. And then I end up doing videos for someone else because I had that. It's like, yeah, there's, you never know what comes from that.
I think that's a great place to end it. So where should people find you?
The easiest place is probably Twitter, I would say, but what I'm focusing now is Village Lane. So we'll start with that as well. VillageLane.io, focusing on building community for a vetted community of startup founders. But I'm very active on Twitter, so Justin Gordon 212, because that's the boiling point of water. That's why. Very strange. But
why is that?
It's like the whole 1 degree extra makes a difference.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
One right. degree lower than that, you're not boiling. 1 degree no more. Motion. Exactly. So yeah. That's why I have that. If people don't know that.
Perfect. Cool. Well, this has been the Creative Spotlight Podcast. Our guest has been Justin Gordon, and I have been and shall remain Francis Sear. I will see you next week.